It is Friday, January the 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up, those peace talks between the Syrian government and the opposition and where Russia stands on it all.
Let's not forget that at the end of the day, they want to either keep Bashar Assad in power or one of his cronies, which is where they might actually go. The less that can be done to harm them, the better off they are. And, you know, their attacks have been fairly successful in going after some of the opposition groups.
Also ahead, who killed Litvinenko and helping the children of the CAR get an education. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Before holding talks in Saudi Arabia on Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is taking part in the 2016 World Economic Forum talks in Davos, Switzerland. For the next few days, it's following his talks in Zurich on Wednesday with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, about political transition talks in Syria. Those talks scheduled to get underway January 25th in Geneva appear to be in jeopardy right now over the lack of consensus over who should represent the opposition. Meantime, UN Syria envoy Staffan de Mistura said invitations to the talks have not yet gone out, and he may not be able to say what those will be until Sunday. University of Denver professor and regional analyst Jonathan Edelman tells VOA's Victor Beatty it's going to be difficult to meet Monday's deadline.
And I think the Russians are playing a clever game. I actually met Lavrov twice before he was foreign minister. He's a very smart guy. He almost functions like a computer. And so he's thinking, let's not give him another few days that maybe they might come up with something more acceptable. Because deep down, they really don't want to do most of this. So they want to just cram the UN and the pro-Western people into a bind, because there's many opposition groups, and the Russians no doubt have them all raided. And so the less time there is to resolve it, the less likely it's going to be resolved. And let's not forget that at the end of the day, they want to either keep Bashar Assad in power or one of his cronies, which is where they might actually go. The less that can be done to harm them, the better off they are. And, you know, their attacks have been fairly successful in going after some of the opposition groups.
Well, what is their game aside from supporting Mr. Assad?
Their game is that this is being looked at from their point of view, not just by Syrians, but it's being looked at all over the world, that Egyptians are looking at it, with whom they have the $2 billion military deal, and they're wondering how serious the Russians are about this effort to get back in the Middle East. Because we all know that the Egyptians, for example, kicked them out almost 40 years ago, and that was true of several other countries as well. So the way they handle themselves is not just a Russian question. It's also an effort to give the impression that we are tough, we're ready to rumble, and if you, and I'm now talking about non-Syrians, want a country you can rely on, unlike in their view the United States, we're going to be there with you down the line.
The Associated Press has an interesting story about the Russian military presence in Syria, saying that they've conducted in just a few short months some 5,700 missions, and according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, Russian strikes are directly responsible for killing more than 1,000 civilians, including more than 200 children. With this horrific cost of these airstrikes, what are they accomplishing?
From their point of view, they're showing that they're willing to do whatever is necessary to keep the Assad regime, and I'd like to emphasize, it doesn't necessarily mean Bashar Assad, but somebody associated with him, in power. And when you look around the Middle East today, for many countries, like El-Sisi in Egypt, for example, they're very nervous about what could be happening to them. So the Russians are showing them, look, we will do what we say, we will intervene, and if we have to kill a few thousand people, we're going to kill a few thousand people because they're supporting hostile elements.
Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov also said he spoke with Mr. Kerry about how the Russian Air Force, in planning its operations, can more closely coordinate with the U.S.-led coalition in taking into account the UN, NGO, and Red Cross humanitarian efforts in Syria.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
British investigators say Russian President Vladimir Putin probably personally approved the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, a Russian spy turned dissident who was exiled in Britain after criticizing Putin and describing him, among other things, as a pedophile. VOA's Luis Ramirez in London has the story.
9-year-old questions of whether Alexander Litvinenko was murdered, who did it, and who ordered it have now been answered. The British government's inquiry conclusion, Russia's spy agency, the Federal Security Bureau, or FSB, and the state itself were directly responsible for Litvinenko's murder by poison. Since her husband's death, Marina Litvinenko has been demanding answers. Thursday marked the end of a long battle.
I'm, of course, very pleased that the words my husband spoke on his deathbed when he accused Mr. Putin of his murder have been proved true in English court with the highest standards of independency and fairness.
Litvinenko was an agent of the FSB, but after becoming an outspoken critic of Putin in 1998, he fled Russia and sought asylum in Britain.
So now I realize the moment has come. I don't fear for my life. I never did. If I were afraid, I wouldn't be doing what I do now.
It was at a bar in this hotel in central London where Litvinenko met with two Russian agents in November of 2006 and sipped tea laced with poison, radioactive polonium. With radioactive contamination spreading from the hotel to the streets, investigators described it as a nuclear attack in the heart of London. After 23 days of agony, Litvinenko was dead. He asked for this photo to be taken to show, in his wife's words, what Putin had done to him. Russian officials deny links to Litvinenko's death, but they have never hidden their hatred of him and their anger over his betrayal. Agents at this training center outside Moscow use a picture of his face as target practice. There are now calls for Britain to expel all Russian operatives and impose economic sanctions on individuals tied to the murder. Britain has strong financial ties with Russia and hopes to recruit Putin's help in ending the Syrian crisis. Analysts say those factors will make it unlikely for leaders here to take any action that would endanger the wider relationship over the killing of one former foreign spy by two others. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, London.
And it's time now to check out what's buzzing online about the Litvinenko case. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to tell us the latest, including what the Russian media is saying about it all. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. Well, as you know, RT is a state-run media in Russia, so it's not surprising they sent out several tweets on this issue. Here's an example. How will the hashtag Litvinenko report affect Russia-UK relations? Give us your thoughts.
Yeah, I understand. Any interesting comments on the RT tweet?
There were many interesting comments, but I have to say tweets that reflect nationalistic sentiments were quite common. One of them reads like this. Do we have a list of all the people assassinated by the UK, the US, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and China? Let he who is sinless cast first stone. But that's like saying we won't mention one tragedy because there are other tragedies throughout the world. But in any case, that was a very popular reply. Another one reads like this. Britain can rapidly produce a report against Russia, but cannot produce a report on the Iraqi war. Hashtag diversion. RT also interviewed Russian ambassador to the UK, Alexander Yakovenko. His Twitter handle, if you wish to follow, is AMB_Yakovenko. And of course, he tweeted about the event. He wrote, on Litvinenko inquiry, we will not accept anything arrived at in secret and based on evidence not tested in open court. Steve?
Many thanks, G. Our social guru, G. Abby Lee. You know, you can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents. a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. United Nations warning that refugee women and children seeking safety in Europe are at great risk of sexual abuse and violence throughout their whole journey. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UN in Geneva.
The joint field mission was carried out in Greece and Macedonia in November. It found those most at risk of sexual abuse and violence include single women traveling alone or with children, pregnant and lactating women, adolescent girls, unaccompanied children, and early married children. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler tells VOA it is difficult to know how widespread the phenomenon is because women are reluctant to speak about their experiences. But he says it is feared the abuse to which they are subjected along the European migratory route is vastly underreported. He says women describe being forced to engage in transactional sex to pay for travel documents on their journey. He says women fall prey to smugglers who demand a hefty price for transporting refugees and migrants across the Mediterranean Sea to Europe.
In some cases, women have been put under pressure to perform sex with the smugglers in order to be allowed to continue. There have also been cases in which women, girls and boys, have lost their money, and therefore the only way that they can continue with the journey, find the money to continue with the journey, is through selling themselves for money.
Spindler says there also are reports of women being sexually abused by other refugees and migrants, and in some cases by officials in countries of transit. He says small boys traveling alone also have been forced to perform sex by smugglers so they can continue their journeys. He says women and children are exposed to many dangers in overcrowded reception facilities or transit centers. He says simple measures such as providing separate toilets for men and women and ensuring well-lit and gender-separated sleeping facilities could reduce the potential risks. Aid agencies are calling for action by European Union governments to protect refugee women and children from the dangers and exploitation facing them and to prosecute the perpetrators of these crimes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Children displaced by conflict in the Central African Republic are getting some help with their education. International Organization for Migration, the IOM, is assisting in the enrollment of children in the primary schools. Ann Schaefer is a senior project coordinator for IOM in Bangui. She speaks now with VOA's Kim Lewis about the enrollment of displaced children and the challenges that they face.
In the past 2 years, a lot of schools have been hosting internally displaced people throughout the entirety of the Central African Republic. This has been a particular issue also here in Bangui, where several of the school buildings host IDPs until today. The education cluster under the UNICEF lead is in the process of trying to find solutions for those sites. There are a lot of IDP children who are usually supposed to be in school who still do not have access to adequate schooling systems, mainly because of the different waves of displacement which disrupted schooling, like the last wave of violence that we encountered here in September 2015, which closed schools for a quite extended period of 2 months, and schools are only very timidly reopening, and parents are very cautious about resending their children to school. There are several activities currently underway to increase reinscription in schools, to reopen schools, to encourage teachers to return to schools, and to encourage parents to send their children back to different education systems. We are seeing trends throughout the country where families are increasingly sending their children back to school. However, particularly for the IDP population, this is still very, very complicated.
Do you see the IDP population continuing to grow at this time?
For right now, the IDP population is stable. It's been stable since late November. Unfortunately, we do not see a very high trend of people returning from IDP sites to their communities of origin. This is mainly due to the ongoing elections. The first round of elections just took place in late 2015 on the 30th of December. And now we're waiting for the second round of elections, which is scheduled to take place in late January, early February. We're still waiting for the exact date to be published. And as long as the elections have not been finalized, IDPs are stating themselves that they will not be returning to their communities of origin. And this, of course, also impacts schools, because a lot of schools are being used as polling stations for the elections, and because a lot of the schools have been rehabilitated and offer an adequate surrounding for the election.
What are some of the other needs of the children at this time?
Well, in particular for IDP children, I think the situation in the Central African Republic in general, in Bangui, as the capital in particular, remains extremely dire. There is not a lot of funding in the Central African Republic to support IDP sites, so child-friendly spaces do exist in some of the larger sites, but not in all the sites. There is very limited support in terms of psychosocial assistance to displaced children. A lot of the families have been displaced several times, meaning they were displaced during the first wave of violence in 2013, potentially have returned to their communities of origin, were displaced a second time, potentially to a second site. So there is a lot of instability also within the family fabric and within the lives of the IDP children who have gone through different waves of violence and different waves of displacement. They lack basically everything that a child that would grow up in a more stable environment would have, and that starts from access to adequate shelter, to non-food items, to recreational activities, and to educational facilities. And not just formal education facilities, but also informal education facilities that could provide educational pastimes for children, and especially for youth.
That is Anne Schaefer. She is a senior project coordinator with the International Organization for Migration. She is speaking from Bangui with VOA's Kim Lewis. Voters will finally weigh in on the U.S. presidential race in just under 2 weeks. That's when the Iowa caucuses will be selecting early favorites. Among the Democrats, Bernie Sanders has made an amazing surge in the polls over Hillary Clinton. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone now speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about Sanders' position in the pre-election voter surveys.
We've focused so much over the past 6 months or so on the rise of Donald Trump in the Republican race, in a way that's overshadowed what's going on in the Democratic race. And a lot of people may be now readjusting their predictions, because Bernie Sanders, not only is he not going away, he seems to be on a mini surge in Iowa, where Clinton has had a lead for a long time. And for a long time now, Bernie Sanders has had a lead in the second state that'll vote, New Hampshire, which holds its primary on February 9th. So a 1-2 punch of Sanders defeating Clinton in both Iowa and New Hampshire certainly would reset the race. It might not make Sanders the favorite for the nomination. Clinton would still seem to be a strong contender. She still has great strengths with minority voters, which are a really important part of the Democratic Party. But we see of late Bernie Sanders trying to fix that a bit by reaching out to African-American and other minorities to try to bolster his support there. But yeah, you know, on one hand, the Trump phenomenon on the Republican side and the Sanders phenomenon on the Democratic side, unorthodox candidates, outsiders, it seems to be the rage for both parties this year.
What are some of the issues that Bernie Sanders is bringing up that are resonating with voters?
Well, you know, he has from the beginning focused on this sort of inequality argument that too much wealth in America is concentrated in too few people, the billionaire class, he likes to call them. I think there's some studies that shows there's several hundred, 500 billionaires in the country. So that's a pretty small group. But this argument that Sanders has been making, that there's been too much concentration of wealth, seems to be having an impact. And, you know, a lot of the candidates are trying to appeal to the broader middle class. And whether it's an economic argument that we've heard from Sanders, Or in the case of Trump, it might be more of a grievance argument, that it's time to settle some old scores and people are angry and upset. Both of these things seem to be reaching voters right now, and I think all the other candidates are taking note. In the case of Hillary Clinton, she's very well known. She offers an experienced candidate. I think they're just a little taken aback at how resilient Sanders has proven. They have their work cut out for them.
Hillary Clinton was, for a while, the presumed nominee for the Democrats back in 2008, and then came Barack Obama. Does the Hillary camp see shades of 2008 starting to reemerge?
They really don't want to go down that road. And some of the supporters, I think, are getting a little worried that we're sitting in the theater and we've seen this movie before. That's why I think they're doubling down now on their efforts in Iowa to make sure the organization gets those people out on a cold winter's night. You actually have to go out in Iowa to a local community center and vote. It's not as though you're going to the polls anytime during the day you want. You actually have to go to a meeting at night. People are trying to convince neighbors who to vote for. And we'll see, you know, who's better organized in Iowa. The Clinton camp says they learned an important lesson from that loss in 2008 to Barack Obama. The question about Sanders is he mobilizing people who normally wouldn't go to vote in the caucuses? I think it's a real tight battle right now, and the Clinton people know that the best place to stop Sanders is at the beginning, because otherwise he could be on a bit of a run with what, according to one recent poll in New Hampshire, is quite a large lead.
That is VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone speaking with my colleague, Jim Stevenson. Well, there are those stock markets out there. We might as well update you on those. U.S. and European stock prices rebounded a bit on Thursday after the head of the European Central Bank raised hopes for some additional economic stimulus. Price of oil, that's one that's been on people's attention, rose above $29 a barrel on Thursday at the close of business. New York's trading on Thursday, the S&P 500 advanced 0.5%. The Nasdaq rose 0.2%, while the Dow gained 0.7%. London's FTSE advanced about 1.8%. The CAC 40 in Paris up 1.9%. The DAX in Germany rose about 2%. Earlier, the Asia market swung wildly, but were down at the close. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
At a berry farm in Mexico, Andy Sia with Fruit Day, a Chinese food importer in Shanghai, is looking over the produce. Fruit Day became one of the first Chinese companies to import berries from Mexico about a year ago. He says, for fresh products like raspberries and blackberries, we use air freight. In this way, the quality can be guaranteed. At this orchard in Jalisco State in Mexico, berries are hand-picked and shipped in special coolers to China, where there's a growing number of people developing an appetite for fresh berries. The president of Anaberries, Mario Andrade Cardenas, says the climate in Jalisco gives his company a big production advantage. He says that makes us one of the countries which can produce berries in winter and spring. Mexican berry producers are optimistic they can turn China into one of the top berry markets in the world, and in so doing, perhaps put a dent in Mexico's $50 billion trade imbalance with China. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Well, two rock and roll icons, Sting and Peter Gabriel, have announced a new North American tour together. International Edition's David Byrd tells us that the so-called Rock, Paper, Scissors tour will have the artists performing not only their own music, but also each other's songs.
Sting, once the frontman for The Police and also a highly successful solo artist, is joining forces with Peter Gabriel, who came to fame with Genesis and has also had a very successful solo career. The Rock, Paper, Scissors tour starts June 21st in Columbus, Ohio. Sting told the Associated Press the idea came after his successful world tour with Paul Simon.
Where we traded songs, we traded musicians, we sang together, and the take-home that people
got from that was the love that when we did things together. So I thought, I'd like to do that again. And who would I do it with? And Peter was one of a very short list of people.
This is not the first time the two artists have toured together. The pair toured on the Amnesty Tour in the 1980s. Peter Gabriel says that experience was one of the best tours ever.
It was, well, we never knew where we were going. We traveled to all sorts of amazing countries, great people, but we had all these fantastic musicians traveling together. There were two planes, one carrying the gear and one carrying musicians. Anyway, so that gave us a sense of what it might be, and it was a lot of fun.
Sting and Peter Gabriel are still working out what they want to play and who will do which songs. But Sting says that both artists know the crowd wants to hear the hits.
I mean, we're in those discussions right now and having ideas of, you know, we want to sing a lot of hits, basically. People want to hear us sing the songs we're famous for. But it's always interesting to trade a song, say, you know, take that one. So I'm not precious about giving him whatever he wants.
Peter Gabriel says he is looking forward to having fun with his friend, just like they did in the 1980s.
It's playful, and I think, yeah, we certainly found when we toured together in the past, there was a lot of, a lot of pillow fights on aeroplanes.
There was pillow fights.
But it was fun. It really was. And there was a lot of great music happening.
And the two artists promise that any disputes on the tour will be settled by the finger-throwing game, which gives it its name, Rock, Paper, Scissors. Though Peter Gabriel says he always waits just a little bit behind his opponent to see what they throw before finalizing his choice. Sting and Peter Gabriel's tour runs through July 25th and ends in Edmonton, Alberta. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And many thanks to you, Dave, and thanks to you for tuning in today to the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, you can find us anytime on the Internet at voanews.com. And we hope that you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. Otherwise, have a great weekend. In the meantime, a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. Eight candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a fifth term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aine, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. It's 4.